He led the UCLA RAND Health Services Training Program and the UCLA RAND CDC Research Center. He was the chair of the Department of Health Services from 2004 to 2009. I just realized that the speaker was down here. From 1997 to 2004, he was a professor and chair of the Department of Family and Preventive Medicine at the University of California, San Diego. He is a past president of several organizations, including the American Psychological Association, Quality of Life Research, the Society for Behavioral Medicine, and the Academy of Behavioral Medicine Research. He is a past chair of the Behavioral Science Council of the American Thoracic Society. Dr. Kaplan is a former editor-in-chief for two different academic journals, Health Psychology and the Annals of Behavioral Medicine. He is the co-author or author or editor of more than 18 books and approximately 480 articles or chapters. His work has been cited in more than 25,000 papers, and the ISI includes him in the listing of the most cited authors in his field, defined above the 99.5th percentile. In 2005, he was elected to the Institute of Medicine National Academies of Science. Okay, you are on.
Well, thank you, Chris. And first of all, I want to say that how regretful I am that I'm not able to join you. I was hoping to get out on Sunday, and I guess I was one of the few flights that was canceled on Sunday, and then trying to call United just didn't work. So I am here with Sandy the hurricane and surviving. So anyway, my apologies, and a special thanks to Chris for all the work she's done putting this together and the heroic effort of coordinating this over the telephone. So are you able to hear me?
Yep.
Good. Okay. Well, let me go ahead and just jump right into it. I'd like to start by saying that the National Institutes of Health has a mission of science in pursuit of fundamental knowledge about the nature and the behavior of living systems. And perhaps most importantly for this discussion, the application of that knowledge to extend a healthy life and reduce the burdens of illness and disability. I was very much influenced, Chris had mentioned my time at UCLA, and I was very much influenced when I was there by two important figures, one, Lester Breslow, who passed away just this year, and Neil Kalfon, a professor of pediatrics and health services at UCLA. And Neil in particular has been talking about these phases of the healthcare system. You might think about the healthcare system as being continually redesigned as a function of new scientific evidence that emerges. So we had an original healthcare system, a system that was designed primarily around the scientific thinking of the time when we were convinced that most disease was associated with exposure to germs. So the germ theory drove our healthcare system, and the goal of the system was to reduce deaths. But what happened was that scientific thinking moved on. The Framingham Heart Study came along, and other large studies of people with chronic illness, and we came to realize that about 75% of the use of the healthcare system is associated with chronic illnesses rather than germs. So now we needed a new healthcare system that dealt both with the germs problems, but also with interventions for risk factors. So, again, that original healthcare system, if you think about it, the way we built hospitals and trained house staff, so forth, was all designed for acute illness. The function of new scientific thinking, the healthcare system had to be redesigned to consider these multiple risk factors. And the goal shifted from reducing deaths to prolonging disability and so forth. And this is essentially our current system. So care moved from hospitals to clinics. There was a lot more work that was done in outpatient settings and so forth. So that's where we are with our current system. But now we've recognized that scientific thinking has moved on once again. We now understand complex systems are driving a lot of the health outcomes and that we need to take into consideration the entire life course. Exposures we have during early childhood might eventually affect the diseases and disabilities that we get as older adults. And so instead of reducing deaths or just prolonging life, now the system has to shift to producing optimal health. So if we look at these systems, System 1.0, again, was our original system. System 2.0 was the system that was built primarily to deal with chronic illness and to move care away from acute and hospital settings into clinic settings. And now we need to develop this new system, System 3.0, which needs to take into consideration that our understanding of the determinants of health are different than they've ever been before. So, as Director of the Office of Behavioral and Social Sciences Research and the NIH Associate Director for Behavioral and Social Sciences, we've come to think about what we need to do in our strategic plans to deal with this next generation. How does our thinking have to change, and how do our directions have to change? We've argued that we need to plan our future around three major pillars. The first is the next generation of measurement and data. The second is delivering health services in a reforming healthcare system. And the third is training the next generation of research investigators. So with regard to this first theme, the next generation of data and advancing science, we are very engaged in a variety of different issues. One is mHealth technologies or mobile health technologies, which I'll say a little bit more about in just a minute. The second is electronic health records. We're very active in a variety of efforts to try to harmonize particularly the psychosocial components of the electronic medical record. The use of system science, the recognition that we are going to have more data than we ever imagined, what we need to do with that data, data visualization, and then new methods of analysis. So with regard to some of our new directions, we've come to appreciate terms like exposomics. I picked up from a variety of people, but in particular, my former colleague Kevin Patrick at UCSD. Everything at the NIH is something about omics. There's genomics, proteomics, metabolomics, and so forth. And we felt that exposomics is actually an important issue that we need to consider. So if you think about genetic exposures, we can code the genome. As you see, if you see the picture that I'm looking at, over the course of the last few years, the expense of coding a single human genome has declined remarkably from more than $10,000 to within the next year or two, it's going to be down to about $1,000. So we've become very adept at coding the genome. On the other hand, coding the exposures that we have has been much more difficult. And we know that together, these two, our genetic exposures and the diseases that we experience, are what determines our life expectancy and what diseases and disabilities we're likely to experience. So there's a tremendous mismatch between our ability to measure and to express our genome and our ability to quantify what we've been exposed to. But we think that the game is changing. For example, there are billions of mobile devices, now about 6 billion in the world. They're literally more sensors. There are many billions of sensors in the world now. And there are billions of social networks, or billions of people using social networks. So we have an unprecedented opportunity to measure population exposures using sensing, cell phones, and other technologies. This is an opportunity that we've just never had before. So I'll give you just a couple examples. Are you seeing the slide with the iPhone picture of a meal?
Right.
Thank you, Chris. So thanks for keeping up with this. So here you see a little app for an iPhone that's taking a picture of a meal. And with this little application, there's software that will estimate the protein, carbohydrate, and fat in this meal. And this might replace the 24-hour diet recall or other methodologies that we've had to assess dietary exposures. The Framingham Heart Study and many major epidemiologic studies were based to a large extent on what people self-reported for selected days. With these new applications, we have the opportunity to collect much more detailed information about people's dietary exposures. Now, I know some of you are thinking that these apps are not very good at this point, and we're quite aware of that. Yet engineers are very good at iterating these applications, and so over the course of time, we know they're going to get better and better. This next slide shows a woman. You can see here in the red top holding a little box. This woman, unfortunately, is infected with HIV disease, and she is in Uganda. And that little box will, at certain times of the day, open Mansberg, who's in Boston, is a PI on a grant that's looking at this issue. And interestingly, he's able to show her adherence on any particular day. So when he gave a talk at the NIH recently, he showed her picture in Uganda. And then on the right of this slide, you can see her adherence for that particular day, or that involving that particular day. If he was in Bethesda, Maryland, and she was in Uganda, really quite a remarkable achievement. The big difficulty that we have with all these technologies is that they're generating so much information that we don't quite know what to do with them. So one of the areas that we're particularly intrigued with is next generation of data analysis and data analytics. Last January, we held a conference on data visualization and visual analytics to help us understand this very complex mass of data that will arrive very shortly. We simply don't know what to do with all the information that's coming in our direction. But there are new ways to visualize data. For example, on this map done by some geographers depicts country size relative to the estimated number of people who are HIV infected. So you can see that although we are very concerned about HIV disease in the Northern Hemisphere, in fact, certain parts of the world, and in particular Africa, has many, many more cases in relation to their population size. Another interesting example of data visual analytics comes from some work that's being done by Holly Jemison. Holly is from the Oregon Health Sciences University and is spending a year with us as a DTL or as an IPA at the Office of Behavioral and Social Sciences Research. So what you see here is you see a little architectural drawing of a home where an older person lives. And then on the left, you can see these sensors. These are actually very inexpensive sensors. They might be part of your burglar alarm system at home, and actually you can buy them for very little money. But those sensors can keep track of a person's movement around their apartment, providing feeds for literally hundreds of millions of data points. So what do we do with all this information? Well, in this next slide, this is Holly and her group's summary of how they deal with all this information. And what you see in this circle is a series of days starting from the center, and so each concentric circle going outward is a day. And in this type of depiction, you can characterize a person's movement within this apartment. So the green dots are when the person's in their bedroom, the red dots are in the bathroom, the pink is in the kitchen, and so forth. So what you can see is that between about midnight and about 7 in the morning, the person spends most of their time in the bedroom. Another feature of this is that when this monitoring started early in the early circles toward the center, the person was not moving around their room very often. But toward the later days, you can see more green dots between midnight and 7 in the morning, suggesting that perhaps they're having difficulty sleeping. You can see that the person is in the kitchen during meal times and so forth. But in fact, with this sort of display, you'd be able to determine when the person was missing meals. So remarkable achievement, I think, in being able to display a lot of complex data very simply. So with regard to data and data analysis, we're very intrigued by the harmonization of data. The NIH is very active in a variety of programs to develop free public use data tools like the PROMISE initiative measures. There's a whole series of cognitive and behavioral cognitive science tools that are part of the NIH toolbox and so forth. We're also very interested in health technologies and data mining, data visualization. So I'd like to go on to the second phase of the second theme that we're developing, which is behavioral and social science in an evolving healthcare system. And I like to tell people that this is no longer so, but believe it or not, I was once young. And in my lifetime, things have changed rather dramatically. So, for example, in my lifetime, the good news is that diseases like coronary heart disease have declined rather rapidly. So with the Framingham Heart Study and a variety of other achievements in public health, deaths from coronary heart disease and other heart diseases have been steadily declining since about 1960. we recently looked at about 60 different systematic reviews of this literature, and the reviews suggest that at least all of the reviews note that about 50% of this decline is associated with public health interventions, that is smoking, high blood pressure, and cholesterol. And the other half is associated with advances in medicines. But actually, that's the most conservative view. Some of the reviews suggest that about 80% of the decline is associated with tobacco use and control risk factors. Another great example of how we've made great achievements in population health is control of tobacco. And during my years when I was at the University of California in San Diego, we ran the California Tobacco Survey. John Pierce and Betsy Gilpin and others were involved with this. During this period, we were able to monitor tobacco use in California. So, Chris, I'm going on to the first slide that shows the state of California. In 1990, there was very little of California where the prevalence rate for tobacco use was less than 19%. But we're going to flip through very rapidly what happens in 1996, 1999, and 2002. And you can see that as we got to 2002, virtually all of the state of California had tobacco use rates less than 20%. And we think that this is quite an important achievement with regard to the control of deaths from cancer. So, for example, the National Cancer Institute suggests that that deaths among U.S. males declined quite rapidly in that period between 1975 and 2000. So a sizable number of deaths that were avoided. But we still have a long way to go. The darker blue in this slide shows that. One of the other areas that we're particularly intrigued by is our population health status in relation to other countries. And so this slide, if it's the one that says trends in E50 females,
yes,
comes from an Institute of Medicine, National Academy of Sciences study that was released last year. And what this shows is the increase in life expectancy for U.S. females in relation to the increase in life expectancy from among females in our economic trading partners or competitors. So I think it is worth saying that that life expectancy for men and women did increase quite substantially between about 1950 and 2010. So that's the good news. But the bad news is that the rate of increase for American men and women did not keep pace with the rate of increase in other countries. So the darker red line in this graph shows that rate of increase for U.S. women. And you can see that it actually started very near the top and among this group of countries and ends near the bottom. To put that in a different perspective, in 1955, the U.S. was about 12th in the world for current life expectancy for women at age 50. So we weren't number one, we were number 12, but we were doing well, and number 12 is pretty good. But in 2010, we were 47th. So in relation to our economic trading partners, we're not keeping pace with what's happening in increased life expectancy. So we need ways to address this. So the most important ways include what we've been discussing, that is tobacco control and risk factor control and so forth. But we also might achieve better outcomes by improving our healthcare system. You might imagine, as the Institute of Medicine had in their release about a week or two ago of their new report on improving healthcare, imagine if other sectors operated like the healthcare system. For example, imagine going to your bank where your bank couldn't find your account. Or imagine a construction job where the carpenters, electricians, and plumbers were all working from different sets of blueprints. Or imagine airline travel where each pilot used her own set of pre-flight safety checks. Or, my favorite example, imagine a restaurant, going to a restaurant where they brought you a menu that had no prices, and then the chef selected what you were going to eat. You only found out the price when you got the bill. But in fact, this is very much like our current healthcare system. So there is a national strategy to improve health and health care, and it has three components: better health for the population, better care for individuals, and lower cost for quality and And I won't go through all of these priorities in the plan, but I think it is worth saying that each of these has a strong behavioral component to it. So we have to make care safer. We have to ensure that each person in their family is engaged as partners in care. We have to promote effective communication and care coordination, and so forth. We know that the redesign of healthcare can have a big effect on health outcome. So, for example, heart failure patients who are cared for in systems that make greater use of nurse practitioners do much better. And we know that substantial redesigns of systems can have profound effects on health outcome. One of my favorite examples, like Chris mentioned in the introduction, that before coming to government, I was PI on the grant for the California Center for Comparative Effectiveness and Outcomes Improvement. And as part of that effort, we monitored a lot of the managed care organizations in California. And in fact, the California Right Care Initiative, with which that center is associated, gives awards to the highest performing groups each year. So, for example, if we look at blood pressure control in California, Kaiser, particularly Kaiser Permanente in Northern California, continues to do better each year. So they're the blue line. The red line is the California average, and the green line is the national average. So that Kaiser started better, and they continue to get better each year. In fact, won our award this year. And this is starting to pay off. These are deaths from cardiovascular disease in Kaiser, Northern California, between 2002 and 2008. And what you can see is that deaths from heart disease in the Kaiser system, the one that's doing the best in risk factor control, are just declining to the point where next year it's likely that Kaiser will have fewer deaths from disease than they will from cancer. Just quite a remarkable achievement if you roll back your clock 30 years. So, the last issue I'd like to just bring up briefly is the next generation of training for behavioral and social scientists. So, as a function of the two other themes in our programs, that is, the next generation of data and analytics and the reforming healthcare system, we now think that we need to address problems in education and training. And these range from the K-12 curriculum, undergraduate curriculum, and the medical school curriculum. Last year, the AAMC released a report on the future of the medical school curriculum, and they suggested that considerably more behavioral and social science content and public health content needs to be part of medical school training. Partially in response to that, the MCAT exam has announced that starting in 2015, about 30% of their content will be behavioral and social science focused. So we think there are significant changes ahead for the medical school curriculum. But I'd like to devote the rest of my time today to talk about changes in the PhD program curriculum, because we feel that PhD programs are not keeping pace with the demands that are facing our graduates. So each year, about 50,000 doctoral degrees are awarded in the United States. And it turns out that more than half of the graduates will end up working in fields outside of academia. Now, at the NIH, we think that we might have the potential to influence what happens because we remain the largest supporter of PhD students in the United States. We support over 23,000 PhD students. The NSF comes very close, about 21,500. And then other departments of government support students as well. And we're now starting to talk among one another about the future of PhD training. So what does the current curriculum look like? Well, remarkably, the curriculum looks very similar to the way it looked when I was a graduate student many, many years ago. So the current curriculum is focused primarily on training people to be university professors. It's very disciplinary focused in most cases. And that the methods that we emphasize in most of our graduate programs are based on sample statistics, inferential statistics. They use non-harmonized measures, and they emphasize statistical methodologies like the analysis of variance and multiple regression. We think the curriculum of the future needs to be different. It needs to train people for a different range of job opportunities. We need to train people to work in teams, in multidisciplinary groups, and we need to train people in a whole different set of analytic strategies. We need to teach people about new big data problems, about harmonized measures, about how to link data, how to recognize patterns within data, and we need to learn more about system science. So, we need to think about how many students we should produce. We need to train people for a more appropriate range of job opportunities. We need to consider whether or not we should be training people in cross-disciplinary science at the pre-doctoral or the post-doctoral level. And we need to think about these students who have been admitted to PhD programs and have started this fall and will be getting their degrees around 2018. We have to ask the question, are the people that we're training today going to be appropriate for the world that they're going to PhD programs for in 2018? So, to conclude, in the words of one of my favorite San Francisco musicians, Jerry Garcia, Jerry once, when he was alive, said, someone has to do something. And it's just incredibly pathetic that it has to be us. So thank you so much for your attention. And, Chris, I'm available to answer questions if you would like.
I think there's actually another session coming in at this point, and we went overtime by 15 minutes. So I wanted that. I wanted your full presentation in because the session is being recorded for continuing education. So I didn't cut you off. So, but I will let people know. And believe it or not, I actually brought some OBSSR cards from the retreat. So if it's okay, I will give them out to people.
Well, thank you so much. And again, I'm very, very sorry that because of the weather I wasn't able to make it. But Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate you being willing to, you know, work with the circumstances. So I'll touch base with you when I get back, okay? Thank you.